So this evening we are graced with the company of a distinguished guest over on my right, Joseph Kappel. I invited to come along and offer a few reflections one of these evenings during the retreat. By way of a brief introduction, just under 30 years ago the roles were reversed. And so he was the senior monk, and I was the guy in the T-shirt in Thailand. In those days, he was Ajahn Prabhakaro and was the abbot of Wat Pa Nanachat, the branch of Ajahn Chah's monastery for Westerners. And I was the unsuspecting character showing up, asking if I could stay for a few days. Definitely, it was not going to be more than 2 or 3 days, and then I was going to move on. So life is full of surprises, and Joseph now lives here in Massachusetts, and his wife, Catherine, is here on the retreat. And I don't know if this is a surprise for her this evening. But, so anyway, I asked him if he would be kind enough to offer a few reflections, and he was a monk for 20 years, and so he has much experience as a monk, and then also since 1991, so now 16 years as a post-monastic lay practitioner. Recovering monastic, yeah, that's the technical term, post-monastic stress disorder. Is a very unique place in the DSM for, you know. So without further ado, would you like to use one of the chairs up here? Yeah, we can bring it forward, and then maybe we could move the cushions a bit. As you like, whatever's convenient with the microphone. Okay. Sure, yeah. Do you want to move the microphone down?
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Homage to the Blessed, Noble, and Perfectly Enlightened One. Homage to the Blessed, Noble, and Perfectly Enlightened One. Homage to the Blessed, Noble, and Perfectly Enlightened One. I think it's important to begin by making a distinction between the t-shirt that I'm wearing this evening and the t-shirt that Ajahn Amaro was wearing many years ago. I'll just talk about this one. He actually gave this to me a little earlier when we were having tea together, and it's a little piggy. And this piggy has a pink lotus that is balancing. And on the back, you can see three little piggies and Thai writing beneath each of the piggies. And this is, for those familiar, this is the year of the pig in the Chinese zodiac. And so Ajahn Jayasaro, who's a senior monk in Thailand and is been instrumental in many of the translations of Venerable Ajahn Chah's and so on, came up with this idea in the year of the pig. And so in Thai, you can kind of play with words. And so there's an expression in Thai, pu ru, pu te, and pu buk ban, which is pu. Pu is like the is like person or one. So it's the one who knows, the one who is awakened, and the one who is liberated, or has blossomed, and liberation blossomed. And so the play on words is the word for pig is mu. It's a different tone, but it's got the u sound in it. So in the back it says mu ru, mu te, and mu buk ban. So it's the pig who knows, the pig who is awakened, and the pig who is liberated. So I sit before you with the three little piggies, and I happen to have been born in the year of the pig, so this is a great and of honor this evening to be here. And Catherine, you have a t-shirt as well that I'll give to you later, so you can join the piggy club. And you'll have to talk to Ajahn Aramyo if you wish to become a member. You don't have to shave your head or anything on that one. So it's a great honor and delight and joy for me to be here this evening. I think one of the most wonderful, inspirational teachings that all of us received living with Ajahn Chah for those many years in Thailand, and then the teachings as they were handed down through Ajahn Sumedho and the various other senior monks, is the ability to develop a gift to be able to speak from the spontaneity of the one's heart, the conditions that one finds oneself in the moment. And I didn't realize that this was quite a gift until years later, because he used to say, and we all kind of faced it in those early years when we were struggling to speak the Thai language, which is simple yet complicated with all of the tones and things, and most of us are tone deaf, so we might be saying, you know, the pig who knows and the pig who is awakened and the pig who is liberated, instead of the one who knows and the one who, just by mispronouncing our tones or the word itself. So he would ask us to get up on the, we had a called the tamat, the dharma seat. It's a high seat above everybody, the teacher, kind of on the same level as the Buddha in the Thai monasteries, and one would bow, ask permission of the senior monk present to ascend to this teaching seat to expound, to talk Dhamma. And Ajahn Chah used to say that just close your eyes, you know, look inward in your own heart, deep within your own heart, and speak from what you know. speak from your heart. Don't speak about what you don't know. And if you don't know, say you don't know. And that gift, I've realized, has served me incredibly well in many aspects of my life. And not being in the context of monastic life and retreat situation that often, that I tend to forget what a great gift it is. And to have the opportunity, as this evening, to be able to speak from and share from that heart brings great joy to me. Usually, he's probably for Ajahn Amaro, Ajahn Punadamo, and seasoned monastics, probably don't give a lot of thought to giving a talk in any given evening. And so when he called me on Saturday and asked me to, if I would be coming out to visit and for the evening, if I'd like to share an evening of reflections, I was delighted. And of course, one's mind begins to then, well, what will I talk about? And one of the beauties of that is that I thought, well, how do you prepare to give a Dhamma talk? Well, how do you prepare to go to bed? How do you prepare to take a shower? How do you prepare to get up? And really the preparation is in what we do in every moment of our lives. So ideally, you and I are constantly preparing for each moment as it unfolds, each situation. And the more that we can be prepared for the unforeseeable events that may unfold before us, from the most tragic, heart-wrenching loss and grief that we may experience, to the most, the deepest, most profoundest joy and bliss that we might experience, that I believe that we're truly preparing for this every moment of our lives. And so the challenge that each of us has is to how we go about that preparation and to face the inevitable facts of life, the fact of our demise, of our that we are all mortal beings, that as we sit here, none of us, when we were born, we got a birth certificate, but we didn't get a death certificate. But they just didn't issue one. We actually got issued one in the real certificate realm that, you know, is kind of stamped on the universal condition of all that is born and arises and comes to being must die, must pass away. And this is a very profound truth. And so in many ways, our preparation is to prepare for that parting, if you will. You can see it as a parting, or maybe it's the beginning instead of the end. And we're just kind of, we tend to focus. Ajahn Chah used to say that everybody celebrates at a new birth of a baby. Someone has a baby, and there's preparations, there's baby showers before the baby, and then there's the baby pictures, and everyone here has seen a newly born baby, and there's not a human being that's probably more ugly than a freshly born baby. It's pretty pathetic looking. And, you know, after a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, a month or so, it becomes very gorgeous. And it's heart-wrenching for all of us to see the innocence of this young infant and helplessness of this young infant. And it's very dependent on mother and father, parents, some kind of fostering and nurturing to care for it. But of course, if someone was to say, well, your child is wonderful, what a beautiful baby girl, beautiful baby boy, but it's going to die. Now, that would kind of spoil the the event. And Ajahn Chah said, well, the birth is when we should be sad and we should have grief and sorrow, because what is the baby, what has it been born into? Well, we're all sitting here at our various ages, and we know 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years. Is anybody here above 90 this evening? Anybody below 20? So I've kind of got the age range. We know that life probably isn't all it's cracked up to be. Ajahn Hanumo and I were reflecting with each other about the, and Ajahn Poonadamo about the aches and pains that we're starting to experience. You know, I can no longer really sit on the floor very comfortably for very long, and he was sharing how well that he's fairly comfortable for a certain amount of time in full lotus, and Ajahn Poonadamo, kind of his comfort time. But it kind of starts to go downhill at a certain age, and that everything is kind of moving towards that demise, that destruction, that deterioration. So we can step back, you and I can step back and say, oh, how horrible, is this some kind of bad dream or a nightmare? Or is this the human condition that you and I have been born into? And of course, if we pause long enough, and in the context of a retreat situation like this, we have the silence and the support to be in silence and to reflect on what is really important in life, the truths in life, that we see that, well, this is inherent. Remember, they used to ask Ajahn Sumedho, they would come with a young child or something when we were living together in England, and, oh, why does my child have to suffer so? And in a very kind of kind and compassionate way, he says, because the child was born. And so with birth, we inherit certain things. Now, if that's all there was, it would be pretty bleak, and we might as well either, you know, have a big orgy and have a lot of fun together and, you know, eat, drink, and be merry. Or if it's not a bad joke and there's, you know, kind of some reasoning behind this kind of mess that we call humanity, then it's like, well, what can we do about it? Well, we can't do anything. We know from history that the Buddha couldn't even escape from back pains, and that he ultimately died, as history has it. So the physical body is bound up with these inherent truths of birth, aging, illness, and death. So it's kind of by default, it's that way. So once you and I can begin to understand this fundamental truth, then we can start to perhaps put more into what it does mean to be alive, to be human, to be on the planet now, and how we can best use our time here. And that is really the big challenge. It's been 1991, March of 1991, March 5th to be exact, 1991, is when I left monastic life. So just over 16 years now, I've been in the world and making efforts to be in the world, to make some contribution in the world, to find my way in the world. And this has been a tremendous challenge. And you might think, well, gosh, he was like 20 years, he was an Ajahn. You know, I'd be sitting up here in the high seat, they'd all be bowing to me, and, you know, everybody says, oh, Ajahn Prabhakaro is teaching this evening, he's going to give a talk, or, oh, Ajahn Prabhakaro, I heard he's not that good a monk, even though he's been around, or whatever other opinion you might have about light maker, which Prabhakaro means, Ajahn Prabhakaro, the one who, the maker of light. And so in many ways, I kind of gave up my status as a monk. I gave up my retirement as a monk because it's one of the best programs out there, the monk, monastic monk or nun retirement program, that basically you're taken care of for the rest of your life as long as there's good people in the world like you and I to support the monastic community, then they will be taken care of. And so it's a wonderful retirement plan because someone will be there to look after you. Your basic needs will be taken care of. I don't know how many are going to come to the monastery after this, but actually, this is all planned. We're trying to get a few more, you know, women in the monastery, and we're looking for volunteers this evening. And those that don't have health benefits, and all, you know, it might be a, it's an option. It's an option. And yet when I left monastic life, I thought that I have a lifetime membership, and I don't mean that lightly, that because the time that I had invested and the closeness, Ajahn Amaro is known, other than my own parents, or my surviving, my mother, my sister, and Ajahn Sumedho, and monks and tons of the community in Thailand, nobody has known me longer, so just shy of 30 years that we've known each other. And so when I left, I knew that that connection was a lifetime connection, that I was not leaving monastic life as much as making a transition from one lifestyle to another, that I would be faced with many challenges and it would be very, very difficult. Little did I know how difficult it was. And I say, sometimes I like to say the first biggest mistake of my life was becoming a monk. The second biggest mistake of my life is becoming a non-monk. I don't know what the third will be. So the important thing to me, and I would, and I believe that to each one of you, when we kind of break down who we are and what purpose we may or may not have in this human realm and condition, that we have an opportunity and we have choices. Everyone is here by choice. No one was forced. You weren't kind of enlisted to come onto this retreat. And this is truly a holy day, holiday. Holy comes from holy, doesn't it? To, you know, kind of to step outside of the daily grind of life and the difficulties, the challenges that we face, and have a chance to step back and to renew ourselves, to renew our commitment, to listen to noble teachings, and most importantly, to listen inwardly to ourselves, to our own heart and mind, and how we're being directed and guided. And that we have no matter where we go. So one of the analogies that I came up with when I left monastic life almost 16 years ago is I was on this huge ocean liner. Like the monastic community was like an ocean liner. And an ocean liner is a pretty secure thing. And it doesn't have all the kind of bells and whistles that the kind of the cruises, but it's got all the basic functions, you know. It's got everything that one needs on this ocean liner. And it's a sturdy vehicle. It's been around for over 2,500 years. And it continues to float and be very secure. So when I left monastic life, I felt like I was jumping overboard. I jumped off of the ocean liner. But I wasn't without a life preserver. You know, I jumped, but I had a life preserver. Now, Ajahn Amaro might have been the one throwing the life preserver. I'm not sure who threw it. But I threw it myself, actually. And I knew my life preserver was a couple of things. First, it was the five precepts. I knew that no matter what, if I kept to the best of my ability the five precepts of virtuous conduct, not to hurt anyone or anything, not to take things, not to be promiscuous or engage in frivolous sexual behavior, transgress anybody's relationship, be careful with speech, and to not indulge or engage in any kind of drug, drink, anything that would cloud my mind, that I would probably be all right. And that's worked. It continues to work to this day. And then secondly is probably refuge in, you know, the one who knows, the one who is awake, the one who is liberated. And of course, everyone knows, theoretically at least, that that is within us, within each of us. So when we chant, we bow, we reflect on those qualities that each of us has inherent, that we need to discover or uncover within ourselves. And this, of course, is the great challenge. And it can be as simple as one awakened moment when we have that kind of aha experience that, wow, how have I been so, you know, deluded and clouded to this life and all of its kind of distractions, to the challenge of being able to just drive down the road. This is one of my challenges, and not get irritated about the all of those great drivers that we have here in Massachusetts. And of course, each of us is driving our own particular vehicle. We all know that we are the greatest driver in Massachusetts, and you know, everybody else is a bad driver, right? True in California too, yeah. So it seems to be more true, you know, more and more places these days. So the great challenge that I find is those daily little annoyances, the little agitations, and everything from being in a relationship to being in a relationship with oneself and the world. And kind of back to, because we were born, we inherit things like aging and death. Also, because we are born, we're sensual beings. We have senses. And so our senses are constantly being impinged on. So either through sight, through sound, through smell, taste, touch, and thoughts, there's a constant impingement on our sense bases. Therefore, when we're in the sensual realm, or the realm of feeling, if you will, to break it down in one of the khandhas, the aggregates of body-mind phenomena, as long as we have this phenomena, then when we have that sensation, the eye comes in contact with a form, the ear comes in contact with a sound, all through the sense bases, then three things basically happen. We either like it, so we're attracted to it, we dislike it, so we're repelled by it, or it's neither attractive, or it doesn't have neither attraction or aversion to it, and therefore it's neutral. And as long as you and I dwell in that realm, that we're constantly in this vacillating, vicious circle of attraction and aversion. We're attracted to that which is pleasant, which we like, which is beautiful, which smells good, which tastes good, which feels good, which thinks good, all through all of our sense bases. And so if we break that down, we have this every day. So do we have a chance to practice outside of a retreat? Anybody? Yeah? No? Anybody having their senses impinged upon in everyday life? None, right? So the point being, it doesn't matter in a way where we are. And yet, I'd certainly be the last one to understate how important a situation like this is. When I left monastic life, one of the things I thought is, I said, well, I've got a pretty thick bank account. I spent 20 years as a celibate monk, you know, cared for Ajahn Chah personally for 3 years and helped establish Dhammarawati in England. I've done some pretty good things. So I should have a pretty healthy, you know, bank account in the, you know, kind of kusala kamma, the wholesome dharmas in the universe. I've, you know, accumulated a fair amount of kusala kamma, so maybe I can just kind of cruise for a while. Cruise control. You know, I love cruise control. You get out on Route 2 or 495, one of the highways, you get up there about 65, hit the cruise control, and you just kind of cruise along. And it's all right. It's like if nothing's in your way, but how often can you cruise before somebody either, you know, comes crashing up behind you and honks at you or blinks their lights to get out of the way because you're going too slow, or someone swerves in front. So we still have to be and have some kind of control. So for me, it's like, even though that's true, that one needs to continue to invest. And so like one good thing that you and I do in our daily lives needs to be followed by, you know, another good thing, a constant cultivation of that which is good, is noble, is uplifting. And it's very easy to know that which is good and uplifting and wholesome to that which isn't, because it's immediate. The result is immediate. We know as soon as we've said or done something that that immediately comes back to haunt us, either in the moment or the moments that follow. Maybe, you know, hours, maybe days, maybe a little bit longer. But the more awake, I believe, truly, that you and I are, the more that we can be on top of or in the presence of that which is appropriate, which is skillful, which is the right thing to do. And there lies the great challenge. It's easy in some ways to come here and be on a 10-day retreat. The challenge, of course, is the transition, the first day, 2 days, 3 days. If we've been on retreat before, we kind of settle in, and then we are kind of like on cruise control. You know, Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Punadamo and Tarani are there in charge of the Dhamma talks. Somebody takes charge of the bell, and somebody is in there chopping veggies, and the meals are all there when we need them. And, wow, it's great. You know, we just kind of sit back, and we just kind of respond as necessary, show up at the right times, and, you know, follow the bells, and we just kind of salivate when we're supposed to, and we, you know, sleep when we're supposed to. And so in a way, it's difficult, it's challenging, but it's easy. And what our hearts really long for and love is that simplicity and that support. That's what I've missed the most from leaving this wonderful community of over 2,500 years, is the simplicity and the connection, the community. And this is what each of us desires most deeply in our heart of hearts, to be a part of something, to truly belong, to truly feel that we're making some kind of contribution, no matter how small it is. And the beautiful thing about the monastic community is that everybody had a place. I saw it in Thailand at 13 years, and I saw it in England the last 7 years of my monastic life, that everyone fit in. There was a place for everyone. And as long as one could, you know, basically kind of fit within the parameters and the guidelines, that there was a place for everyone. And in that place for everyone, that everyone has a contribution. Say maybe you're a kind of a quiet, you know, monk or nun who basically just goes about your life, comes out for the meals when necessary, is there for chanting, do chores to participate in whatever way you can, but you don't say a lot, do a lot. But you just harmonize. Your kind of strength is harmony. You harmonize with everything. There's kind of not a discord of a cell of discord in your whole being. Well, that's an incredible contribution. It'd be nice to have a few more running around, wouldn't it? That just kind of, you know, are in total harmony with all that is going on and all is around. And then there are those that are very skilled in, you know, building, or those that are skilled in being able to, you know, organize people so everyone fit in. And so now here you and I sit in this time of great complexity and confusion in our world. Where do we fit in? It's kind of difficult to say, well, where do I fit in? And if we go outwardly on our sense bases, then it's hard to find a fit. You know, where do I fit in the realm of the senses? Because there's a gazillion fits out there. But if we turn inwardly, then our fit can be, how do you and I harmonize with the way things are, with the unfolding of the life force within us and with all around us. This doesn't mean we become passive. We can become very active. We become proactive instead of reactive. Another great challenge that I face is to be more proactive than reactive. You know, I grew up basically either being kind of passive-aggressive or being reactive. I never learned how to be proactive, to find my voice, be able to express myself, make my contribution. And that's one of the biggest challenges, and why I believe I left monastic life, along with many other things, is to find more my individuality. And this is fascinating, because the number I were talking about this, and in Buddhism, we talk about the three characteristics of all existence: anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Anicca, all things are transient, bound up with change. Nothing is holding still. It's all in a kind of vibratory kind of state, and it's transitioning always. You know, our bodies, the weather, everything around us, everything that has some kind of form is arising and passing away. Therefore, it's dukkha. And suffering's all right, but dukkha is just simply that it's nature. Because it's transient, there's nothing that we can kind of stop, hang on to, and say, yes, this is it. You know, if I hang on to this, I'm there. I'm going to be happy. I'm going to be fulfilled. You know, I'm going to love. How many times have we thought we're going to get it? You know, big one for me is kind of the next thing. You know, I desire the next thing. I get that thing. And it just seems like, oh, it is the thing. I had it as a monk as well. You know, it was like the, you know, the best tractor tires in Thailand that I could find to make my own sandals, you know. And then when I got them, you know, they weren't necessarily the best sandals, but they were good. So I had this kind of thing about quality and to, you know, the nicest material. I mean, trust me, desires can go in a lot of strange places when they're kind of channeled into some very basic needs. And so those kind of that channeling of that energy and where we put it is important. And so we do have a certain choice and control. So most of my life had been in institutions. First family life, I had a very controlling father. Then I joined the military. I'm a Vietnam veteran. You know, was in the military for almost 4 years. Served in Vietnam. Flew helicopters. Got shot at. Shot down. Shot up. And still here to talk about it. And then I decided to change my uniform from the kind of olive drab to the, you know, wonderful kind of Gan Canoon, the jackfruit, beautiful jackfruit. We use the jackfruit. The wood of the jackfruit tree is the original, as we understand it, dye. You get that kind of ochre, that beautiful kind of brownish, reddish earth color. And so I traded my olive drab, which is kind of the most, you know, boring of the military, for my monastic robes, took off my hair. So I joined another institution. Same haircut, yeah, pretty much, yeah. So I had not really discovered my individuality. And so as we were talking, Ajahn, it's like if we take then the concept from anicca, dukkha, anatta, out without self, it's pretty hard to begin to grasp that, even intellectually, before we discovered what a self is. We have some kind of thing to identify with, you know, the body, our mind, the name, the history, and all of these things. So we kind of have to have some grasp of it before then we can have something to let go of. It's not like we were just kind of born into the great, great void, and that we establish, you know, all of these conditions around ourselves. And so what was important to me is to find that individuality. And so this is kind of the other extreme from total, just the Pavlovian kind of dog, to just salivate when we're told, to total rebellion, and it doesn't matter what I do because I'm me, and the heck with everybody else. So what is the balance, you know, in between? And so I think there's a constant struggle of how we participate and be part of community where we're making a contribution, but also our individuality and being able to, what are you and I passionate about? What do you or I believe in? What do we want to, how do we want to contribute? What do we want to invest our life force energy into? And there's a wonderful analogy. Not an analogy. I don't know how many here are Star Trek fans. Not the old Trek, and not which I'm not that great a fan, but Next Generation I loved. And then my all-time favorite, and they're being recorded as we speak here at home, the Star Trek Voyager. And I don't know how many watch Voyager, how many Star Trek fans, but I'll get you up to speed here in a moment. What's that? And in Star Trek Voyager, basically they've been stranded. They got thrown from the Alpha Quadrant, which was still in fairly close proximity to Earth, into the Delta Quadrant, which was like gazillions of light years from Earth. And so the whole series is based around getting home, this crew getting home. And Gene Roddenberry was a very insightful, brilliant man, the how he's written these things. If you really watch them, there's some very profound things. And it's really strange. All of the strangest, kookiest looking beings that they create on Star Trek, they kind of look like humans at the end of the day. You know, they all have this kind of human quality, because of course it's humans playing these, you know, kind of weird creatures and aliens and so on. But there's one species called Borg, B-O-R-G, so like cyborg. So they're kind of a combination of human and or whatever their organic, whatever their species were, they have that organic part. And then the Borg part is that they're implanted and they have technologically advanced being. And what the Borg does is they assimilate other species. And so their whole thing is assimilation. So when the Borg approaches, they basically, you know, your kind of time is up. You know, they comes over this kind of one of these deep kind of voices. We are Borg. Resistance, you will be assimilated. Resistance is futile. And, you know, it's really powerful. The first time I saw the Borg, I mean, they were really scary because it's kind of like these humans and they move with robots and they got these nanoprobes that they stick in here and inject these things. And basically you start this transformation to become a Borg and you become part of the collective. You lose your individuality. And so the whole thing with all these species from the Star Trek Voyager crew to everybody else are trying to maintain their individuality. And the Borg are trying to reach perfection by assimilating all these species. So they grow. Each species they assimilate, they gather that knowledge and become better and more closer to perfection. So I think that's a wonderful analogy because I think, you know, in our lives, it's like there is that which is trying to basically assimilate you and I, and then we have this thing we call a self that's trying to struggle and not be assimilated. In other words, we don't want to return to our source. We don't want to return to where we came from or realize that we never left in the first place. And so we hang on and we resist because of our individuality. And yet the longing, the real fulfillment, I truly believe, is being able to kind of return or come back to that collective mind. When one reads in scriptures and other sources about, say, the five khandhas, you know, body, feelings, perceptions, mind, formations, and consciousness, that there's only one set out there. There's not like you don't have an individual set. When you begin to tap into, there's just one, and it's all connected. It's all interconnected. So sanya is basically the storehouse of all that has ever happened and ever will happen. Because it's already happened. I guess it's not going to happen again. I'm not going to try to get my head around that right now. But so when you and I tap into that deepest source, we're actually tapping in to, I believe, a collective. You find it in different psychological disciplines. And as you dig more deeply, that basically if we just take the physicality of our existence, the four elements, earth, fire, water, and air, that we're just part of the four elements. There just is the four elements. It's manifested in the different forms that we have it, but we're all a part of. You know, if this was to, once we kind of make that transformation, we return. The earth returns to the earth element, the fire to the fire, the air to the air, and the water to the water. So in a way, we're just living out that manifestation in different ways. And we have our individual karma, as it were. But our individual karma is what really is keeping us from returning or from kind of harmonizing with the way things are, with, you know, the truth of our existence. So the great, great challenge that we face is, one, I believe, how do we use our time? There's a saying in Thai, say, the days and nights are swiftly passing, what are we doing? The days and nights are swiftly passing, you know, or what am I doing? So we're not stopping the days and nights. They're swiftly passing each day, each night. So what are you and I doing? What can we do? What do we want to do? What is our passion? What is our, what is it in our heart of hearts do we really want to accomplish in this life? And so that is the great challenge, to pick that up. And we have in the form of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, of these great teachings, that we have a very, I believe, clear and well-defined path. But within that path, we also find our individuality. How do we walk that path? Some of us are going to walk a little faster. Some of us are going to walk a little slower. Some of us are going to kind of be at about the same pace. But the important thing, all the great teachers I've ever lived with, is that we stay on the path. So Lumpa Jamnian, who's still alive, and I've helped translate for many years, it's just, and Ajahn Chah used to see the same thing. He said, I just sit here. He says, I don't have a really difficult job. I just sit here and watch people, and they're going down the road. Oh, a little bit back to the left. Oh, a little bit back to the right. So just kind of telling people to come from, you know, the extremes, falling into the ditch, basically, and get back in the center of the road. But if we don't have someone over our shoulder to tell us where the center of the road is, then, you know, you and I need to find the center of the road. So how do we know when we've fallen in a ditch? I know how I know when I've fallen in a ditch. And I think each one of you does as well. When we fall in a ditch, is basically well, there's a kind of a stuckness. There's a stagnation. Because things are moving, can you and I continue to move with it, to flow with it? And, you know, therein lies our daily kind of unfolding and the investment that we put into, you know, our practice. So when you know, you hear the house shake and you hear some deep kind of voice come over that we are Borg, you will be assimilated. Resistance is futile. Well, then maybe you shouldn't resist. So to be assimilated, it may not be such a bad thing. So I've been kind of toying with this this as I was watching these Star Treks. I thought it was quite fascinating because everything is fighting there to remain an individual. And yet the Borg, could we call that evil? Well, we could, because it kind of wipes out species to become part of the One. Well, you know, maybe it's not so simple as it's good or it's evil, or, you know, it's a little more complicated than that. And I believe everything in life is kind of a little more complicated than what meets the surface. This evening, this is what I have to offer as a reflection this evening. To once again express my deep gratitude and delight to Ajahn Amaro, Ajahn Punadamo, for allowing me to be here and share with you this evening, and that I do wish in my heart of hearts that each of you is able to take some small part of perhaps what I said that will help you on your path to liberation, to freedom. And something I always like to end with is to wish that all the forces of goodness, healing and well-being is present in each one of our lives. That each one of us is freed from anxiety and sorrow, and that each one of us awakens to truth and to escape from forgetfulness and realize our true home.